Chapter 33 The Stuff of Kings. We sat hip to hip on the edge of the well for a long time. Neither of us did any speaking. I was leaned over with my elbows atop my knees, staring into the dirt between my feet because I really couldn't stand to stare at anything else. Sometimes boredom seemed to get the best of her and she'd bounce her foot a bit. I'd see it out of the corner of my eye and get distracted, the slender perfection of her arch or the rounded grace of her heel. Even covered in that dark goop, I could tell it was more than just an appendage. There was true art in that limb, true art in every atom that composed her body, as if she'd been created by a master craftsman with a natural instinct for the divine, a sculptor who could set raw sexual desire at war against angelic chastity on a canvas of flesh and bone. I thought about these things. I thought about how everything the gods did was according to a plan and what that meant for Apicia's appearance. When a human is born, the only control he or she will have over appearance is limited to choice and circumstance. How healthy is this person? How hard have they been forced to work over the period of their life? Any scars? Any diseases or maladies? What about diet? Do they get the nutrition they require? And how old are they, while we're at it? The young are usually beautiful, even when they're not, if that makes sense. A young man or woman might be a little cross-eyed or buck-toothed, or might be otherwise superficially blemished, but as they are young, so too will their skin be smooth and supple. So will the softer parts of their bodies continue to resist the pull of the ground. Male and female alike will exhibit healthy, exuberant chests and bellies with no sag, no loose skin to speak of. Their eyes will be bright and shining, and even if that person had been cursed with a pig's nose, still their youth would impart a kind of beauty that age will one day rob. Their youth is like a fading illusion. You look at them one day, see their vibrancy, and say, "Ah, well, that is who this person is." And that's how you'll think of them. You can't see years ahead when the skin loosens and the teeth yellow and the eyes dull and the hair grays. And then, when all of those things happen and the illusion of youth has faded, the newly aged had best be beautiful in truth. If not, their departed vitality will have left them paupers. I thought about these things, sitting on the edge of a well in the silent village of Araa. The illusion of youth's beauty and the perfection of a goddess's foot. The perfection of all of her, really. Since my initial merge with On, I'd learned a few things. I knew certain things without understanding where the knowledge had come from. Even now, as I sleep in the core of my ship and record these thoughts, new things that I've always known come tumbling out of the darkness to remind me they are there. They are essentially memories formed in reverse, and are therefore usually hard to find. When a human forms a new memory, there is an experience that connects that memory to a place and a time. Wherever that person was when they learned this new thing, that place will be connected to the knowledge, so that the retrieval of one virtually guarantees the recollection of the other. Smells, tastes, sounds, age, tangential life experiences, who that person loved at the time, who that person hated at the time, the feeling of his or her own body, their dreams and fears, friends newly made or long departed, all of these are tied to that one kernel of knowledge through a redundant, confused web of neurons. Any of these little bits of data are equally retrievable, any one item a ready stepping stone to the next. And the owner knows this. He knows that if he cannot retrieve the thing he learned, he has only to think about what was happening in his life when he learned it. What were the smells of the time? Who was his lover? Was he waiting to get back to her while forced to reside in this place, learning various things for which he cared little? Any of these links, successfully recalled, will carry him to the memory he seeks. The bit of knowledge might be the solution to mankind's avarice, and the smells of that moment will have been catalogued in his mind with equal importance, so that to him, the relief from bitter, hateful greed will forever be tied to the smell of the jasmine flower. And the jasmine flower will always smell of peace. None of the new things housed within my mind had been attained in this fashion. There was no experience of having learned the thing, therefore the memories were anchored to nothing. They drifted through the hidden darkness like shapeless obstructions, featureless shadows dotting an unsure landscape. It was only when I tripped blindly over a memory and skinned my knee upon it that I was aware of its existence. Then I was free to sit down and examine it and wonder where it had come from, and wonder also what it meant. Of course, there was no context to any of the new things I knew. At one point, I suddenly understood there was once an organization of kings, queens, and high nobles called the United Coalition of Spacefaring Nations. It was composed of many kingdoms, including America, Russia, India, and China. When I found this within myself, I had no idea what any of the words meant. I didn't realize that Russia or India were simply kingdoms on some lost world. I thought they were the names of people. I had to speak with the ship some time later to understand it all, and in so doing formed a basis of retrieval. But now, when I think of the United Coalition of Spacefaring Nations, the memory of this group is tied indelibly to the conversation I had with the ship. I no longer remember what I was doing when the name presented itself disconnected from understanding to my conscious mind. One of the things I'd learned, and that I happened to know when I sat upon the well next to Irpisha in the silent village of Araa, was that gods do not inherit their bodies from their ancestors, as do humans. The gods' primary essence is the intellect. Their bodies are utilitarian things, husks necessary for interaction in humanity's physical realm, which are ultimately cast off and discarded as the serpent sheds its own skin. The gods design their own form. They choose their appearance. I knew this. I also knew that for a god, the idea of physical copulation was fundamentally uninteresting. Physical pleasure was a sensation they understood, however, their psychology lacked the triggers necessary to make them crave it. They'd even engaged in sex with humans in the past, but usually this was done either as an act of kindness, a reward for some valued service, in other words, or as a means of control. But to their minds, the mechanics of sexual intercourse are about as engaging as the mechanics of polishing a spoon. They simply take no delight in physical pleasure. The act is akin to the clasping of hands and nothing more. Less than, even. For a human, clasping the hand of a loved one is comforting. And I wondered about that. I wondered what would inspire Irpisha to wear that body and that face. What were her thoughts as she shaped flesh and knitted muscle to bone? Did her appearance portray her own ego? Or worse, did her appearance demonstrate a desire for control?
"You haven't said much," she prodded.
"Yes, it is hard to know what to say. When it's laid out in the open like that, I don't know what to say at all."
"You knew this was coming."
I shut my eyes tightly and nodded. I know. It was, not real until just a moment ago. I didn't even realize I'd be given a choice."
"You've had the power to choose this entire time."
"All right."
"I'm serious. You could have backed out at any point."
Yeah, I get that. You've told me as much, but, you know, I didn't want to. I sure didn't want any of this, but I also didn't want to say no to you. I guess you'd say I wanted to do it because you asked me to."
"And now you're wondering if you've been manipulated."
I didn't say anything.
"Udo?"
"Yeah?"
"I said you're now wondering if you've been manipulated."
"Well, have I?"
She laughed. "Of course."
"Right," I shrugged. "Fuck." She took my hand in hers and squeezed it. I loved how it felt and wanted to pull away. I didn't.
"Don't be that way," she said. "Console yourself in the knowledge that you may have been stumbled upon. That's certainly true. But that as I work with you more, I've only become more convinced of your suitability for this great task.
If you say so.
I do. The fact that you fail to see it in yourself only reinforces my belief. Do you know what the difference is between yourself and Dietmar?
I scoffed. What, you mean besides breeding and bearing?
The difference is that between the two of you, he wanted to rule. That may seem like a small distinction, but it's the only one that truly matters.
I flicked my fingers at her. Yeah, wise men have been saying that since before I can remember. I understand the priest of Godon makes much of such ideas during a coronation.
Clichés exist for good reason, Udo.
I hung my head and offered a tired laugh. Another of those words I know for no reason at all.
Let me ask you something, Udo. What is it that you think makes a good king? Or a good god, even? Do you really think a being is formed with perfect wisdom intact? If you looked at any king as a newborn babe, do you imagine the child's face would be illumined with unseen light? Would you hear the choir sing when staring into his eyes? Or would you be looking at yet another new-formed person who is, at heart, a blank slate, an ignorant creature, as often as not wallowing in his own shit and wholly dependent upon the care and consideration of the adults who live with it? All humans start in this way. Isn't that so? A baby, having just learned to crawl, would just as happily crawl through dirt as he would over a bed of satin. He'll play with pearls or mud equally, and either will be fascinating to him. What is it, then? What is it that makes a person kingly? What makes him fit to rule?
I wanted to say I didn't have any idea, but that wasn't true. Of course I had ideas on what would have made a good king. We all did. We certainly didn't give voice to these ideas, not in public. This was conversation for the alehouses, to be whispered in dark corners where others could not overhear. But I thought about her question, and she waited patiently. After struggling with it, I was finally forced to say, "It's easier to define what a good king does not do, rather than what a good king is."
"This sounds interesting."
"I don't really know. But what I think is that there are many ways to be good, but only one or two ways to really avoid being bad. The easiest example I can think of would be if you were to consider two kingdoms at war. Or don't even make it kingdoms. Let them be opposing houses."
"That's fine, I understand what you mean."
"All right, so two houses, kingdoms, whatever. You take the ruler on the right hand." I held my right hand up to her. "Let's say his is the territory being invaded by the man on the left. Now, I've known a lot of people who would claim his only option is to fight. But that's not really true. He has several options. He could renounce his seat, for one thing, just step down and hand things over to the invader. That's one option. He could fight, like I said before, or he could find some way to negotiate a peace. Who knows why the left-handed king is invading? His people need food, maybe, or maybe they're being run out of their own lands by something even worse than the people they're invading. I don't know. But the right-hand king, in opening discussion with the invader, might find some path toward peace that didn't involve the death of a bunch of soldiers who, let's face it, probably don't really care one way or the other, so long as they're not mistreated. What choice do they have, really? You go fight, or they fine you, or maybe throw you and your family in stocks if you refuse to go. Or maybe you get tortured or killed. They know that marching off to fight is better than the alternative, and beyond that, they don't really care. So it's the kings who hold all the cards, and like I said, you could have a king choose to abdicate, to fight, or to negotiate. And any one of these might be the actions of a good and noble king. Or they could be the misguided decisions of some incompetent, and even then it wouldn't necessarily mean the king was completely useless. There have been kings whose peacetime rule was characterized by prosperity and wealth, but who fought poorly against outside aggressors, and so toppled from the throne. Was that a bad king? Or was that a king fit for a certain kind of world, and the world itself just wasn't good enough to deserve his rule?
This doesn't feel like you're coming any closer to an answer, Irpisha said.
No, it certainly doesn't.
Then for now, just explain the one or two ways a king should avoid being bad. I thought about the question while the sun dimmed further and the village crouched in wait.
Well, I suppose, that is, I was going to say...
I fell silent again. Then,
what I was going to say was that a king can avoid evil by taking only those actions that minimize the hurt done to the most amount of people. But after discussing the different ways in which a king can be good and how those different methods can be in conflict, I'm realizing that the same applies here. I'm not even sure that I can define what's strictly good for the most amount of people. Suppose my nation was starving and a neighboring realm had fewer people but plenty of food. Well, if I marched over, killed them all, and took their food, that might be defined as a good act, right? I had many people who required food, and a smaller group had to make a sacrifice to feed them. I've got this phrase that keeps circling around in my head and no fucking idea where it came from. It goes, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And that feels like it applies, but it also feels like a convenient way to justify the destruction of a people unable to defend themselves. And that seems very evil to me.
I would agree, Irpisha smiled.
So I don't know. I guess I would say the good ruler is one who impacts his subjects' lives as little as possible and just lets them go about their days in whatever way seems best to them. Sometimes you might need to call on them for something, a war or maybe elevated taxes to pull through a famine. Sometimes they'll need to work through difficulties together. But I think if he tried to hold to that ideal, to just leave people alone, he might have a chance of doing the job well.
And what of evil people, those who would wantonly harm others?
Oh, well, you've got to have some laws. People can't just be taking liberties with each other. But I think you have to believe the people you're ruling are basically good. Sure, there'll be a few rotten ones, but a group of people living together? They tend to look out for each other. The low are weeded out and expelled pretty quickly.
Put them where they belong, eh? With the diggers, rubbishmen, and cloakers? I sighed.
Well, I never claimed to know what I was doing anyway.
She raised an index finger up to where I could see it. And that, right there, is the reason. Dithmar knew, beyond the shadow of a doubt, the appropriate way to rule. You have just admitted you haven't a clue.
This is a functional basis for godhood?
It is a foundation. She curled her index finger so that her hand formed a tight fist. It resembled a slim and very precise hammer. Gods and kings have this in common, Udo. We rule with one hand open and one fist drenched in blood. The acknowledgement of our own fallibility must be attained before wisdom is achieved. And wisdom, true wisdom, is the final, most critical aspect of a good ruler. I had no response. As usual, we'd talked in circles, and I felt no closer to understanding anything. I assume that this world is a no for you, she finally said. I nodded.
These people are broken. I pity them, but I can't. I don't know what to do for them. I don't know how to breed spirit back into an animal that's been fundamentally broken. The best stable masters I've known never sought to break the animal. They only worked with it so that it found an understanding of and respect for its master. These made the finest chargers. The animals that have been broken fully were good for little more than pulling a cart.
No matter, she stood and dusted the backs of her legs. There are many more from which to choose.
Well, do you have a world where the folk haven't been so egregiously manipulated?
There are varying degrees, but every world is an experiment.
Yes, I muttered.
I have an idea. There is a world with no real land at all, save for a few islands here and there, filled almost entirely with water. The people there live on floating villages and—
I have an idea, I interrupted.
Yes?
Take me home.